Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping employers get their people home safely. Preventing workplace accidents protects families and keeps businesses productive. More at TexasMutual.com.
From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, a school bus tour is highlighting the mass shootings of Texas. With extreme weather now the norm, some Houston residents are transforming their homes into emergency hubs. And a state program designed to help people pay off old traffic tickets instead is pushing the low income further into debt.
Folks come to us in a seemingly inescapable cycle of ticket debt.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. It's been more than 2 weeks since three San Antonio police officers found Melissa Perez in a mental health crisis and fatally shot her. Her family has filed a lawsuit and the police department charged its officers with murder. The Pettis family says this incident is just the latest at SAPD where there's a culture of excessive force and where the department doesn't properly supervise its armed officers. Disciplinary records of the two officers raises the question about how the city holds its officers accountable. TPR's accountability reporter Paul Flab reports.
The city and its police force quickly condemned its officers for shooting Melissa Perez. Within a day, they'd arrested the three officers even before the ballistics reports were in. San Antonio Police Chief William McManus says the issues here were egregious but isolated to these officers.
That was the issue here. We have no gap in our training or our policies that would have allowed for this to happen.
And a federal lawsuit filed against the police questions what good are SAPD policies if officers don't observe them. TPR found 8 suspensions between Elazar Alejandro and Sergeant Alfred Flores, many of them for serious violations of policy. Flores was nearly fired in 2017 for an off-duty altercation and an investigation that found he was regularly leaving his patrol area to go home. The indefinite suspension was changed to one for 10 days. Alejandro was suspended for unnecessarily breaking down a door in a person's house.
What you saw here was officers who were engaging in conduct that was outside, not only outside of policy, but sort of had the character of officers being a kind of a law unto themselves.
Jonathan Smith was a Justice Department official who ran the Civil Rights Division, which investigated police departments. He says the record of Sergeant Flores was especially troubling because he was able to rise through the ranks despite several infractions.
Suspensions of this length are unusual. 15-day suspension, a 30-day suspension, those are long suspensions in this context. I mean, Flores, from 17, 18, 19, and 21, he had 3 serious infractions. And that gets really close to career ending in most departments.
Smith also said the police department doesn't seem to take into account past infractions in promotions or in progressively harsher punishments, as they would have in other police departments. In an email, a department spokesman pointed to some discretion given to commanders to not promote because of suspensions, but until recently, past union contracts had prevented them from progressively punishing officers. What surprised Theron Bowman, a former police chief in Arlington, Texas, who was a policeman for more than 30 years and now runs a consulting group, was that the department didn't take non-punitive measures in the suspension paperwork, like sending people back to the academy or retraining.
I would have expected to see some amount of retraining. I didn't see that. What I'm saying is punishment alone is usually not sufficient to correct conduct or correct behavior.
SAPD employs what's called an early intervention system, a computer system that collects lots of data on officers and flags behaviors, civilian complaints, and can refer officers to their officer concern program. It isn't clear if any of these officers have been referred to the program, and the city has asked the Texas Attorney General to keep civilian complaints and performance evaluations of the officers involved in this shooting confidential.
And you can have pristine training and terrible supervision and culture, and you come with these outcomes.
Smith says that with all these deficiencies paired with this deadly encounter, that SAPD may be contributing to a culture where excessive force is tolerated.
You have to hold people accountable. You have to supervise them. You have to train them properly. You have to have proper policy guidance. All of that was on display in this incident. And like I said, you can't tell everything about a department from this incident, but boy, there's an awful lot that seems to be exposed by what happened here.
Culture to Bowman is key to how police behave.
So yeah, culture is critical in how the police officers act and behave. And in the absence of policy guidance, appropriate supervision, appropriate accountability, the culture will be the guiding light for that that officers will follow in making decisions and taking actions out on the street.
City and police have been sued at least a dozen times in 10 years for civil rights violations. In that same period, 114 people have died in custody of the police. Perez's lawsuit alleges that 96 of them were at the hands of police.
Yeah, I think 96 in custody deaths over a 10-year period is a lot for any major city in the United States. I'm not familiar with the situation or circumstances, but to have an average of almost 10 a year is a lot. That strikes me as being a lot.
Investigations into the officers awaiting indictment continue. And the federal lawsuit against the police force may offer new insights into how the police police themselves. I'm Paul Flavin, San Antonio.
A converted yellow school bus has been making an unusual trek across America. This week it stopped in Santa Fe, Texas, Uvalde, and then El Paso, all locations of horrific mass shootings. The school bus is part of a new effort to raise awareness about gun violence and the call to pass gun reform laws. I was in Uvalde for the stop of WOC's Magic Tour. Stop Gun Violence is painted on the side of the bus, and it's on a nationwide road trip organized by Manuel and Patricia Oliver. 5 years ago, their son Joaquin Oliver was one of 17 people killed in the mass shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida.
The number one goal here is to create awareness. I don't have the power to do anything else.
Manuel Oliver says he's hoping that by connecting the multiple mass shootings, he's able to amplify his message that something needs to be done about gun violence in America. He'd like to see a ban on assault-style weapons. And on this national tour, he's also connecting on a personal level with families that have suffered a loss similar to his.
I see Brad, a father from Uvalde, that now he's, I consider my friend. And I see him and we connect.
Brett is Brett Cross. His son, Uzziah Garcia, was killed along with 18 other children and two teachers at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde. He says working with the Olivers has helped him deal with his grief.
They've become family. You know, us in this club, we become family because we're the only ones that know what this feels like. And we don't want anybody else to have to feel this way.
Rhonda Hart's 14-year-old daughter, Kimberly Vaughn, was killed in the Santa Fe, Texas high school shooting, along with seven classmates and two teachers. She's standing in front of the school bus in the 103-degree heat and speaking to a crowd who wants to see tougher gun laws.
The only reason we haven't had a school shooting for the last 5 or 6 weeks is because school is out of session.
Manuel Oliver says the tour in his son's honor will visit 25 cities affected by mass shootings. He's hoping to build momentum and eventually end in Washington, D.C. with a caravan of school buses to make a huge statement. I'm David Martin Davies in Uvalde, Texas. A Texas program designed to help people pay their debt from old traffic tickets has left more than 600,000 people without a valid driver's license. Critics say the program traps the low income in a spiral of debt and red tape. From Dallas, KRA's Christopher Connolly has more.
Donna Alexander spent almost two decades dogged by traffic tickets she couldn't afford to pay. It started in 2002. She got stopped for an expired registration. She couldn't afford the registration fee, she says, and definitely couldn't afford the ticket. She was a single mother working two jobs, raising three kids.
And a payment plan wasn't an option at the time because all my little money I was making, it had to go to, you know, eating and having a place to stay.
Alexander's jobs require her to drive, and she got more tickets over several years. Three for moving violations like speeding, eight were for other things, like she couldn't renew her license because of the unpaid tickets. And she got tickets for driving with an invalid license.
So it just kind of compounded itself, you know. I just kind of put it in the back of my mind and just prayed and just did what I had to do.
About a decade ago, though, Alexander tried to work out a deal. She did more than 450 hours of community service to satisfy the old tickets. It took her over a year, but she finished and thought she was on track to get her license back. But then, she says, a court clerk told her that she had to pay more than $300 in fees right before the court's deadline, which she couldn't do.
You can't set up no payment plan. You have to pay it. And when you don't pay it, the tickets don't go away.
Those fees and her unrenewable expired license stemmed from a state program called Failure to Appear, Failure to Pay, though most people just call it Omni or Omnibase after the company that runs the program. Judges issue Omnibase holds when people don't show up in court or don't pay their fines and fees. They can't renew their driver's license until they resolve the court debt. Almost a million Texans have active Omnibase holds.
Folks come to us in a seemingly inescapable cycle of ticket debt.
Sarah Mae Jennings from the Texas Fair Defense Project says Omnibase holds are concentrated in low-income zip codes and disproportionately impact Black drivers. When people can't renew an expired license because of an Omnibase hold, they may still need to drive to get to work or school or doctor's appointments.
Then they're putting themselves at risk of incurring additional tickets, additional warrants, additional fines and fees on this cycle of ticket debt.
One researcher estimated that Omnibase holds reduce earnings by over $5 billion a year in Texas.
When we're talking about indefinite driver's license suspensions, it is just ruining Texans' lives.
Harris County, Austin, and the city of Dallas have stopped using the Omnibase program. Jennings says research shows jurisdictions that don't use Omnibase actually collect more ticket revenue than those that do. But bipartisan efforts to repeal the law at the state legislature have repeatedly failed.
There may be research that says it doesn't work, but I'm here to tell you from personal experience it does.
That's Waller County Justice of the Peace, J.R. Woolley. He told lawmakers in April that he didn't want them to get rid of a tool to force ticket compliance.
I probably get five people a week that have an Omni hold that contact my court to deal with the citations that they did not deal with initially.
For Donna Alexander, though, she went to court. She did hundreds of hours of community service, but still couldn't get her license back because of the Omnibase fees she couldn't afford. It would take several more years and a volunteer lawyer to clear out the old tickets. I'm Christopher Connolly in Dallas.
With frequent hurricanes and flooding now almost the norm for Houston, some there are looking for ways to respond. Some Houstonians are transforming their homes into emergency hubs for their neighborhood. Houston Public Media Environment reporter Katie Watkins got a tour.
From her house in Northeast Houston, Doris Brown has endured so many extreme weather events, she has trouble recalling them all.
Oh my God. I think two or three hurricanes. Harvey was the most devastating. I had Imelda. We had Ike. We had Uri in the freeze. That almost killed me because my house is all electric.
Northeast Houston, where Brown lives, is one of the most flood-prone areas in Houston. Even just heavy rains can leave Brown and her neighbors trapped in their homes waiting for help.
I couldn't leave. I was a prisoner in my own home. And that has gotten to be on a regular basis now that we have those heavy rains. When it rained two or three consecutive days or real heavy all at once, I have a little river floating down my street.
Brown didn't want to feel powerless, so she and her neighbors hatched a plan. They turned their own homes into these neighborhood refuge centers for extreme weather events.
It was happening a little bit too often. So now we decided to take care of ourselves and we come up with the hub houses.
Brown's home is one of these hub houses. Her neighborhood worked with West Street Recovery, a nonprofit, to create four other hub houses in Northeast Houston neighborhoods.
I'm what they call a block captain.
That's Carolyn Rivera, who lives in the Settegast neighborhood and turned her home into one of the hub houses. She says she met with her neighbors to decide what supplies the hub house should have.
Let's go. It's in the garage.
Her garage is lined with rows of wooden shelves, neatly stocked up with disaster supplies.
We have vests, because sometimes people are leaving their homes and they need those vests. We have a kayak, hand sanitizer.
They've thought of everything.
Bug spray, soap. Here, this is for repairs, gloves, duct tape.
We have There's a section for cold weather and for extreme heat. Each hub has solar panels and a backup battery so it can operate off the grid during power outages. Neighbors can also check out their own generators.
We have everything they need to be comfortable until they can get back into their routine. I've lived here many years, and during the disaster, we did not have people to come and help us.
As climate change fuels more frequent and more extreme weather disasters, this concept of neighborhood-level resilience hubs is spreading across the country. They're being set up by nonprofits and local governments. Harris County is also working on a pilot project to install solar panels and backup battery systems at 16 county community centers and libraries.
When there's grid challenges with either extreme heat or extreme cold, and these are the type of critical county assets that really need to stay online.
That's Lisa Lynn, the county's director of sustainability. She says during the winter freeze, one of the libraries was serving as an overnight warming shelter.
Then that eventually went offline too, and so they actually had to move those residents to another location. And so that was one of the things that had kind of come up when we were talking about like potential library sites. What were the areas that really served these community members?
Doris Brown in Northeast Houston says she already saw some of the benefits of the hub house. Storms in June knocked out the power in her neighborhood, but the lights at her house stayed on.
So I winded up having about 15 or 20 people here. You know, the babies had to keep the milk cold, you know, and stuff like that. And then I had a neighbor with oxygen and needed their oxygen and stuff. So everybody was in the living room, in the kitchen.
With hurricane season underway, Brown says she feels more prepared. I'm Katie Watkins in Houston.
Just outside of Odessa, there is a small national natural landmark identifying one of the only known asteroid craters in the country. It doesn't look like much. Rocks jut out of the ground, and there are signs warning visitors to look out for snakes. But about 60,000 years ago, when woolly mammoths and saber-toothed tigers roamed the Earth, an asteroid slammed into what is now known as West Texas. Now a researcher is taking a closer look at Odessa's meteor crater to see what she can find to help respond to future asteroid strikes. Marfa Public Radio's Mitch Borden takes us there.
You probably know the story, and maybe even have seen it play out at a movie theater. An asteroid is headed towards Earth, and the clock is ticking before disaster strikes.
Oh my God!
What?
That's it!
What?
That's the comet!
Meteor shower!
It's what we call a global killer. The end of mankind.
My God. What do we do?
That's what Polish planetary geologist Anya Losiak is trying to help figure out. Losiak is a Fulbright scholar and researches asteroid craters around the world. I met her recently near Odessa at a crater site where she showed me around.
So right now we are in the middle part of the crater. So you can see here, not very deep hole in the ground.
Yeah, it's not very deep because by space standards, it was made by a small asteroid. Instead of giant asteroids, Losiak's more interested in minor space rocks, like the one that made the crater we're standing in, which was about as big as a mid-sized car. Pointing at stones emerging from the ground like rows of jagged teeth, she says these smaller asteroids are still powerful.
Just imagine how much energy do you need to lift this block up. It's absolutely crazy.
According to Losiak, it hit so hard it caused an explosion equivalent to an atom bomb. And if we'd been here back in the Ice Age, she says we would have been toast.
It is probably the luckiest spot to be standing on because your death would be very quick. You would not feel a thing.
Part of her research is looking for the charred remains of any plants or animals caught in the blast radius. This is a part of her effort to better understand how hard smaller asteroids hit and how they affect the surrounding area, which could actually help save lives.
So only by studying Odessa and other craters like that, we are able to understand how far do we need to evacuate people from if we will know, for example, that within the next day or so, there will be, you know, a collision.
This isn't just a hypothetical threat. Smaller asteroids are much more likely to strike Earth than larger ones, which the Russian city of Chelyabinsk found out in 2013.
It came out of nowhere, a blinding flash of light, and then all hell broke loose.
Without warning, an asteroid around the size of a house suddenly appeared and exploded over the city, shattering windows and injuring over 1,600 people, according to NASA.
Smaller objects are much fainter in the sky. They're hard to pick up when they're far. And so really, you can only detect them when they're making the final approach to Earth.
Davide Farinocchia is a navigational engineer with NASA's Center for Near-Earth Object Studies. He calculates the trajectories of asteroids in our solar system to help figure out if they'll strike our planet. According to him, situations like the asteroid that exploded over Russia are a once-in-a-lifetime event. But Farinocchia says it's good to have plans in place if astronomers suddenly spot an asteroid hurtling towards a city.
Like if you had something like Chelyabinsk that you discovered 10 days before impact, what would you do? Well, you need to notify the government of the country that could be affected and support evacuation.
NASA has found about 90% of all asteroids that will come near Earth's orbit and are a kilometer or larger in diameter. But according to Farinocchia, we're far off from being able to reliably detect smaller objects, like the asteroid that made the crater near Odessa. Losiak says she's amazed by the destructive power that minor asteroids can unleash, which makes exploring craters thrilling.
You can see what happens when extraterrestrial material impacts the Earth with the hypersonic velocities. It's amazing. Sometimes very deadly and terrible things are also very exciting.
Even though it could be decades before another asteroid poses any kind of threat, she says we should try to be as prepared as possible.
Only if we know exactly how those things were happening in the past, we are able to avoid similar fate in the future.
Losiak plans on returning to West Texas next year with a team of researchers to scour the Odessa meteor crater to see what it'll reveal. I'm Mitch Borden in Odessa.
For years, a group in Abilene has hosted a summer camp for refugee children who've resettled there. But this summer, they took their game on the road. As KACU's Heather Claiborne reports, the volunteers just returned from Warsaw, Poland, where they held a soccer camp for Ukrainian refugees.
Abilene-based Play for More usually runs its camps with help from Abilene Christian University's women's soccer team. As the group planned for its June Poland trip, they recruited others, like Annie Escobar, an ACU junior from Honduras.
Soccer has been like a positive outlet in my country. You know, we suffer a lot of political turmoil, and soccer has influenced their lives a lot. So I wanted to do the same for these kids.
Before the trip, she joined team members for a one-credit class on working with displaced people, taught by the regional director of the International Rescue Committee.
It's important to have positive outlets and positive engagements with other people, learning how to trust in each other. That's something that they lose whenever they experience these things.
When Russia invaded Ukraine, millions poured over the border into Poland, including its capital, Warsaw.
At some point, we had 3 million people coming extra to our city in a period of 2 months, and that's like doubling the size of our city.
Maciek Lazinovich, pastor of Life Church Warsaw, started helping early on.
Any charities, any churches are welcome to help. We've been there on the streets just giving food, blankets, trying to organize some structure for the refugees.
By last summer, Warsaw was serving more than 150,000 Ukrainian refugees. And people like Lazinovich were thinking about the community's long-term needs. His group realized some 600 residents at one refugee center were school-aged kids with nothing to do.
They've already lost 2 years of education because of COVID, and now they've lost another almost a year because of the war, so their education will just drop. So my big idea was to set up a school.
The U.S.-based organization Love Does helped Lazinovich make it happen, hiring some teachers from among the refugees. But he still wanted to do more for the kids. Love Does connected Lazinovich with Jason Morris, the founder of Play for More in Abilene.
Play for More has a mission to serve refugees. And so part of our outreach is doing soccer camps. And high on my list was serving those Ukrainian children coming over after migrating from their country during wartime.
Once in Warsaw, organizers divided the camp into two groups. Younger kids started the day with a vacation Bible school, then joined the older kids for soccer in the afternoon. Annie Escobar volunteered to mentor one camper, Sasha, who had extra energy and was struggling in the group setting. She says one of her favorite moments was when Sasha set aside his own chance to connect with a man the kids saw as a sort of celebrity to instead mentor the younger players.
Sasha was probably 8, and these kids were 6 and 5. He started hugging all the little kids and was like, oh, like, I'm glad you're here. You're going to play soccer with us? I'm so happy you came. He really wanted that paternal figure to see him play. But then when he saw the kids, he would rather be the paternal figure of these kids instead of finding his own.
For Jason Morris, the highlight of his trip came at the end of camp.
Many of the refugee soccer players would ask us to sign their jerseys and their t-shirts and their shoes. Our team brought some Ukrainian flags for them to sign and that we could take back and have that memory. But you could really tell at the end it was an impactful time.
The camp showed just how much the kids need to be active. Now, Maciek Lazinovich says local volunteers in Warsaw are trying to keep up that momentum.
As we speak now, the soccer camp continues its work, maybe 1 hour or 2 hour classes once a week, but that's not enough.
Lazinovich says his dream is to build a full-time sports center to serve both refugee and local kids in Warsaw. Everyone involved says they hope the war ends soon and that the kids can return home to Ukraine. But Play for More volunteers say they'd love to make the trip from Texas to Poland next year if there's still a need. I'm Heather Claiborne in Abilene.
A new immersive art experience called Meow Wolf is opening this weekend in the DFW area. KERA's Michelle Aslam got a first look tour of the exhibit, and she got a little lost along the way.
I'm standing in front of a two-story brick house inside Grapevine Mills Mall, in a space near the Rainforest Cafe. It's 10:30 in the morning outside in the real world, but here it's nighttime. The lights are on inside the house and it looks like somebody might be home.
Welcome to the home of the Fuquas.
That's Will Heron. He's the artist liaison for Meow Wolf and our tour guide for the day. As we poke around rooms and closets, Heron warns us that in this house, nothing is what it seems.
There's rumors that there are some interactive things.
Every room, sorry, portal, that I follow Heron through feels more surreal than the last. We walk through dark, twinkly forests, a glow-in-the-dark aquarium, and this neon town straight out of a sci-fi movie. Somehow, we end up in this creepy, colorful convenience store designed by Dallas artist Yana Payusova.
And the room is called Kunstkamera, which is based off of this post-Soviet, post-USSR kind of stores that would pop up after the fall of the USSR.
One wall in the room is red, covered in illustrations of eyes. The other side is black and gold, with these cartoonish ceramic heads lining the wall. I assume they're customers. The store is filled with these ceramic knickknacks, like medicine bottles, a gas mask, and a watermelon, beautifully painted in Payusova's whimsical Gothic style. It even features some clever wordplay.
So if you even look at the details of like the teas that are available in the Kunstkamera, we have normality, calamity, morality, and anxiety as our tea blends.
Payusova is one of about 40 Texas artists that Meow Wolf invited to contribute to these artistic spaces.
So you'll see lots of different artistic perspectives and styles that are homegrown here in DFW.
When the tour ends, we have some trouble finding our way out of the exhibition and back to the mall, but Kelly Schwartz, who's the general manager, says getting lost in the art is kind of the point.
So when our guests come here, what we hope is that they arrive curious and that they leave like with their imagination opened and just thinking about what might be possible in the world.
She says Meow Wolf's mission is to make art feel accessible to everyone. Visitors will be able to get lost on their own adventures through the Fuqua family home when Meow Wolf finally opens its doors on July 14th. From Grapevine, I'm Michelle Aslam.
That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can email us at texasmatters@tpr.org. There are past Texas Matters episodes on our website at tpr.org, and you can download, subscribe, and rate us wherever you find cool podcasts. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping employers get their people home safely. Preventing workplace accidents protects families and keeps businesses productive. More at texasmutual.com.